Hello and welcome to this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is one of this country's most distinguished journalists, Ian Jack. Ian Jack has had a long career in newspapers, notably the Sunday Times, where he made the genre of long-form reportage his own, and The Independent Sunday, which he co-founded and edited. He was also for a dozen years the editor of Granta magazine, and today his writing regularly appears in The Guardian. We met to discuss his selected writings from the past 20 years, entitled The Country Formerly Known as Great Britain, which already makes clear Jack's concern to investigate what our nation was and what it has become. But this is no exercise in nostalgia, as you'll hear. Before we got on to the book, there was something to clear up. Was it true that in the 1960s, one of Ian Jack's first tasks as a young reporter was to edit the Fish Price Report for the Glasgow Herald?
Yes, it is true. It was... It's a very lowly task, editing the fish prices. And in those days, they used to come down by, I think, telegram. I may be making this bit up, but I think telegram from Peterhead and Bucky and Aberdeen and Anstruther. And they had things like tons and creels. I always remember creels must have been a description of quantity. So it'd be 62 creels of whatever. And they had to be edited and knocked into shape. But that wasn't as much fun as editing the weather, which was more fun than editing the weather, because the weather had, this was on the Daily Express later than the Herald, the weather had a little woman called Iris, which is what they called a stock block. So Iris, a little woman, sometimes with an umbrella, sometimes playing golf, sometimes in a swimsuit, to indicate various kinds of weather you could expect in the west of Scotland. Completely unrealistically, actually, in terms of the swimsuit. And then you'd have to compose a little caption underneath. It would say, Iris says, and then you had to write two or three words in italic, you know, take your brolly today, or pack the swimsuit, or whatever. So I did that for a bit as well.
And it sounds like you really learned the value of words there. You talk about, you know, fitting a subhead into a particular number of lines, and really having to think very hard about the weight of every word.
I think that's probably true. I mean, you know, I wouldn't want to go down the kind of Graham Greene route in which he's partly ascribed his success as a writer to his days, you know, cutting copy on the Times. I mean, I don't think I'm that good a writer for a start, not compared to Graham Greene. So I wouldn't want to exaggerate it, but I do think it teaches you a certain discipline, first of all about length, and secondly, so length is about kind of redundant word use, and secondly about clarity. I think newspapers are all their faults, and these were, I mean, I was working on a broadsheet popular on the Scottish Daily Express, a category that no longer exists. For all their faults, you did have to be clear, otherwise your 655,000 buyers wouldn't understand what you're on about. So clarity was important, and brevity also. So I suppose, without turning myself into an entire product of tabloid journalism, as it were, you did learn those things. And of course, there are many different ways to write, George, as you know, so I wouldn't say that every writer has to be like that. In fact, some writers are successfully prolix. But I suppose the kind of thing I have written tends to depend on clarity and information a great deal. And journalism, reporting, sub-editing is about those things.
And who did you look to in those days when you were starting out? Who were the sort of models that you admired for their prose?
Well, actually, somebody I perhaps wouldn't admire so much now was James Cameron, who was a very distinguished journalist up until his death in the 80s. Latterly, he had a Guardian column, but he'd worked on Picture Post and the News Chronicle. And he was a very liberal journalist, very liberal reporter. He took up causes and espoused causes. And he had been actually trained as a sub-editor in Glasgow, in the very place that I was working. So I suppose there was a bit of fancy about me that I could maybe become like him. So he was a model. I suppose the writers I liked then would be Graham Greene, certainly. I used to read him. George Orwell, certainly. And by the early 70s, V.S. Naipaul. If I can do this kind of retrospectively, I think that was roughly the order of people I liked reading. But there are many, many others, of course.
And this collection selects from your writing over the past two decades. But I wanted to ask you, if you remember, what your first long form piece was, because that really is a genre you've made your own. So when did you first have the confidence and the license, I suppose, to undertake that for the first time?
I know where the license to write a long form piece came from, the Sunday Times Magazine, which in those days was perhaps the only place in Britain, in British journalism, that encouraged that kind of writing, at least had enough people doing it to have a kind of school of writers like that. America, of course, in the New Yorker and Atlantic Monthly and Harper's, has many places where that's encouraged, but in this country it's not really encouraged. It wasn't very easy to practice anyway. So I began, I suppose, to do it for the Sunday Times Magazine, and the piece, it wouldn't be the first piece, but the piece that people tend to remember is the piece in which I compared Liverpool and Turin in 1985, shortly after the Hazel Stadium disaster, in which many fans of the Italian team Juventus died in a riot with Liverpool fans. And that comparison between Liverpool and Turin in 1985 was, I think it was quite illuminating, really. Because Turin was a kind of successful, prosperous culture, which, you know, like good food and making motor cars. And Liverpool was none of those things, really. So that was the piece, I think, that I remember as being the most successful of those early long-form pieces.
And did you feel then that you had found your genre? Did you feel that allowed you to do things that you really wanted to do that shorter pieces simply didn't?
You know, sometimes I'm like a lot of people who've been reporters. Sometimes I think the best things I've written have been in a telephone box with half an hour to go before the deadline, because there's something about panic that leads to great crispness. And sometimes if you're just describing something you've seen, it's vivid. I think this piece was collected by some sports annual. I did a piece when the Scottish football team lost to Peru in 1978 in the World Cup, and I had to do it at terrific speed for the Sunday Times. I mean, what it would have been about half an hour for about 800 words, and that's, I mean, I'm not really a fast writer, so that was a great strain. So did I think that long form pieces were what I always wanted to do? I suppose I didn't really have that degree of sort of intentionality or ambition in me, really. I kind of drifted into it. And I began to enjoy it because it does allow you, it allows you to construct a narrative, really, and allows you time to find things out. I mean, having time is a great luxury now. Oh. And I think outside a very few places in this country, which I guess Granta Magazine would still be one, it's very difficult for a journalist to find that kind of time now, because time is money. Oh. And I was lucky to have been, you know, working through most of my life anyway, in a kind of era in which, you know, the Sunday Times made money, and you were allowed to go off, and sometimes they say, no, this hasn't worked, and they put it on the spike. And, you know, I mean, I went to Nepal once, and that happened, and that would never ever happen now.
Tell me about the business of putting yourself in the frame, because that's very characteristic of your journalism. You might, you know, no matter what the subject is, at some point you will reflect on your own experience, mm-hmm. your own past, often your own family background. Was that something which just sort of bubbled up naturally?
Well, you know, that there's a saying by Kenneth Graham, who wrote Wind in the Willows, that when he was being asked to write something, I think he said, I am a spring, not a pump. So I don't think it bubbled up naturally. Well, let me think about that. I remember being asked to write a piece on the traffic in Buchanan Street, Main Street in Glasgow, well, one of the main streets in Glasgow, which was being problematic even in the middle 60s, because they clearly needed some kind of one-way system. So I went out and wrote a piece about what I'd seen in Buchanan Street, and I said, in one sense, I said I saw a lorry or two lorries or three lorries. And I handed the piece in, and the news editor said, he said, that's quite good, son, he said, but I don't like this I saw business. He said, we'll have to convert that into the passive tense. Lorries were seen. So in traditional journalism, in that kind of, you know, quality provincial newspaper, the word, the first personal pronoun, was absolutely taboo. I mean, it was just, you just couldn't do it. And I think I began to do it, and the journalistic eye, as somebody once said, different from the novelistic eye, in the capital I in both cases, in that what the journalistic eye really allows you to do is to move between the street and the room, or wherever you want the story to go. The reader has a very, doesn't have much idea of who this I is. It's just a kind of device, and that's how it began, I think, with me. But the turning point, I suppose, in my reporting or writing life came when I had to introduce my first collection of pieces called Before the Hall Ran Out, and I came across a manuscript that my father had written before he died about his own life. And that piece was intensely personal. It was about his life and my life and my brother's life. And that was a terrific, I remember writing that. It's about 16,000 words long. And I suppose the question I kept asking myself was, who is interested in this? I mean, who is really interested in this? Which, of course, is not the question the novelist asks. The novelist is there to create an interest in it. And people were interested, and it touched a lot of people, and people were very nice about it and wrote to me about it. But conquering that idea that yourself, you were merely a kind of, I am a camera, I'm on a wall, I'm a reporter, I just report what I see, that took quite a bit of breaking down in me, and I suppose in many other people in my position. So after that, I began to see that actually, this sounds incredibly vain, it's not meant to be. I began to see that actually my own life was not without interest.
And the
because
piece
it was like a lot of other people's lives.
And the piece you mentioned about your father, mm-hmm. I suppose, has a counterbalance in the piece called The White Elephant about your mother,
yes.
which appears in this book,
yes.
in which you reflect on her life, and she also wrote some reflections towards the end of her life.
She did. Both my mother and my father was a more kind of, he probably had some bit of him perhaps that wanted to write. He was a great letter writer. He liked writing. He'd often take his chessboard out, which he'd made, and put a writing pad on it and write a letter in fountain pen. He enjoyed doing that. He enjoyed keeping scrapbooks. And it was my brother, in fact, who persuaded him to write that account of his life, as it was my brother also, who said to my mum, why don't you just write it down? Just write down so we have something to remember, so we know what happens here. And it seemed a shame not to do anything with them once they had been written. It's a great impulse these days to set down your own experience. It's called life writing. And there's indeed professional classes in it in universities all across the country. And it's very difficult to tell people when they submit these things, as again, I guess you will know as well as I do, that although it's perfectly interesting, and it would be very interesting to the 10, dozen, 24, 100 people who knew this man or this time, to make it as interesting to a bigger audience is a difficult thing. So they might as well just publish it privately or put it on the web. And you might say, well, why didn't I think of that? And I thought, well, no, I think this is more interesting than that, because I suppose there's a kind of writerly vanity in me that thinks that's the case. Well, I mean, otherwise writing wouldn't exist at all if there wasn't a kind of vanity about it. But no, I mean, I think that was when it happened, I think about 1985. And I began to see that it's just, people do it all the time these days. I mean, my goodness me, I mean, if you look at columnists, you can read about their cups of tea and what's in their fridges, what they think of X, Y, and Z. In fact, you might argue there's actually far, far too much of it.
Well, sometimes the life writing class seems to me to precede the life.
Yes, well, there's that thing about there was a time, maybe it's passing now, there was a time certainly in the maybe 10 years ago when people didn't write first novels, they wrote first memoirs. And that was clearly bonkers.
And what this reflection on your own past enables you to do, it seems to me, is to measure change, to see the distance we've travelled, not just you in your own life, but we as a society. And that's a very, it's almost platitudinous, but that is a central theme of the book, isn't
yes,
it?
Sure. It is. A word I've come to try and avoid is nostalgia, because I hope it's not nostalgic. I mean, at its best, it may be slightly elegiac, but I don't think it's nostalgic. Yes, because, I mean, well, it seems incredible to me, actually. I don't want to think about this too much, because it suggests terrific age, which I don't feel, but it seemed incredible to me that I was 2 years old when India was got its independence, and right, my childhood was spent in a different, not just my childhood, my teenage years, my early adulthood were spent in a substantially different country to the one we live in now. And I don't think that kind of thing can be best explored by kind of quick TV shows about the pop music people were listening to in 1972. You know the kind of show I mean? Which you've got six kind of sub-celebrities who give their opinion on, you know, singer Y in 1972 and what they thought of 1972. Because everything's reduced to kind of cliches and kind of easy phrases. So I think it's an interesting thing to do. And I'm not a terrifically kind of polemical writer. I admire people like, you know, like some of my fellow columnists who can have two opinions a week. They are certainly springs, not pumps. But I'm not like that. I tend to see things in terms of stories and pictures, really, rather than opinion. So it's kind of, I suppose it's a thing I do quite naturally, really, is in some way evoke or remember how things were and how they've changed.
I mean, you very clearly, and the front cover of the hardback of your book pays homage to this, you very clearly have a strong admiration for making things, for things that work, for things that do things in the world. I was really struck by the fact that you say 1900 Lancashire was responsible for manufacturing 60% of all the cotton traded in the world. And it's an astonishing kind of statistic. And that kind of thing. And also, you know, how railways work from the track level up, you know, clearly fascinates you.
It does fascinate me. Maybe part of this can be explained by a certain feeling of inadequacy or guilt even. I mean, my father could make things. He made many things in the house. He was absolutely typical of his generation and class in that sense. He made toys for me. He made model Chinese junks and railway locomotives. He repaired washing machines. And he was an engine fitter, so he worked at a lathe every day. Or not just a lathe, but he would repair equipment and machinery. And even steam engines at one point in his life early on. And I was never very good at any of this. I was kind of hopeless at metalwork at school and not very good at woodwork either. And I was no good really with my hands. So you might say that even I've got a kind of, I overvalue people who can do these things. I don't think I do, but I certainly value people who can do that. And I value manufacturing and making things as a way of life and as a way of living and as a way of earning this country's money, most of which is now gone. And I think that it's the lack of valuing that has led in all kinds of ways. I mean, it's not just a kind of narrow political subject, this. I mean, I think the culture at large for the last maybe 100 years hasn't really valued it. I think British decline in manufacturing began in the 19th century when the Germans, you know, discovered chemistry, how to make chemistry work. I think that there doesn't seem to be an answer to it, because it's really hard to know how we would come. I mean, there's Germany. Germany makes lots and lots of things very well. Sweden still makes quite a few things. I mean, there are many countries in Europe that still make things, and what we really make are aero engines quite successfully. Whiskey and a few other things like that, but nothing substantial. And of course we make cars, but they're all foreign-owned companies. I do feel that something has gone missing, and I don't think it's been replaced by, in the long term, by the City of London or financial trading. I don't think that is a kind of solution to what you might call the British problem, which is how do we earn a living.
There's a piece which I guess one might call out elegiac when you go back to Dunfermline, which is the town where you were educated and you spent a fair part of your youth. And you say the reason for decline there, and the decline is very evident from your prose, is not poverty, but rootless wealth. And that seemed to me to be a sort of diagnosis that perhaps applied more widely than just the case of Dunfermline.
Yes, I went to school in Dunfermline. My father came from Dunfermline. And Dunfermline, even when I was in it, was a place with little spike. The horizon was spiked with little. The skyline was spiked with factory chimneys and church spires. It was kind of a well-knit town. You know, it had shopping streets. It had a Gothic town hall. The first library ever founded by Andrew Carnegie was in the room, which is where I worked when I left school. The football ground was quite close to the high street. You know, everything was kind of compact and neat and busy. There was a bookshop there and four cinemas and a dance hall, two dance halls. And what happened in Dunfermline really was that the motorway striking north from Edinburgh to Perth passed a few miles to the east. So they decided to build houses, private housing estates, spread towards the motorway. Then they decided they'd relocate, you know, a shopping mall, a Tesco, the cinema even was relocated to the motorway with four or five or six screens. So that the town kind of collapsed, and that's happened, of course, in many places. But completely needlessly, it was money that did it. It wasn't the fact that Dunfermline got poorer. It was the fact that the money in Dunfermline simply fled to be close to the motorway.
I want to try conjecture out on you, Ian. I think the same things that you value and cherish in the mechanical world are actually exhibited in your prose, where things are working in harmony, working just the way they should. They're not. There's nothing extra. There's nothing taken away. Because it struck me, a sentence like this. This is in your piece on Hatfield, and you're writing about rails. You see, a steel rail to support and guide a powered wheel, a flange on the wheel to keep the wheel in place, result, traction. And it seemed to me a very Jack sort of sentence, because everything's working. And I wanted to ask you, was that a difficult, maybe you don't remember, but do you work very hard to get a sentence like that? Because it seems on the face of it quite smooth and easy, but I imagine to get it all to work properly in the right rhythms and repetitions was no small matter.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I find writing really hard work. I always have done, really. And I most people I know who write would say the same thing. I don't sit away at the computer and laptop and, you know, it just doesn't all come streaming out like some kind of volcanic flow. It's chipping away, really, at things. And I suppose I'm glad you like the sentence. I mean, I can't remember writing it, but I suppose somehow making things clear to yourself is the first stage in many bits of writing. Making it clear to you, and then thinking, well, I can visualize this. I've made it clear to myself now. So how can I make it clear to other people? And I think that's, you know, journalism is a funny word. Let's just call it writing. I mean, that non-fiction writing of that kind really depends on that. It's why you do it, in a way. It's to make something clear to somebody else. I mean, I was very lucky in having Harold Evans as an editor at the Sunday Times. And he had an almost kind of Victorian penny encyclopedia approach to the world, really, although I don't think anybody's quite put it in those terms. But he really believed that almost anything, in fact, anything could be explicable to the readers of his newspaper. So it was kind of Victorian penny encyclopedia in the sense that he say, gosh, you know, Etna's exploded. Shouldn't we know about how does a volcano work? So there would be an artist would be commissioned to draw the inside of a volcano. There'd be diagrams, and then somebody would talk to geologists, and there would be, you know, 1,000 words on how volcanoes work. It sounds remarkably simple, and perhaps even to some extent juvenile, but it certainly told you things, and I think that's something that more and more I begin to miss in communications, in newspapers and television, really, that they kind of assume you know, but they're really more interested in the row about this thing. You know, it's whether X or Y agree with what's about to happen, or interpretations of what's happened, than actually what has happened.
And I guess it comes back to cost, doesn't it, as we were saying earlier? Because you've got to pay somebody to go and investigate what the magma chamber is and what it does. And it's easier to get two talking heads on and just let them argue.
Yes, you're right. So that's the great paradox of the age. One of the great paradoxes of the age is this, that everybody always says, oh, we've got, you know, information. We've got so much of it now. We've got so much information. It's everywhere. And indeed, it is everywhere. But it's rarely brought to you as a kind of unsuspecting audience, as anything other than a kind of, either it's personified as a kind of celebrity, you might say, or it's dramatized as a clash. But rarely is it simply explained.
Ian Jack. The country formerly known as Great Britain is out now in paperback. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast, but you can find out more about the book, plus several million others, by going to blackwell.co.uk.